she was like. I mean, of course she was saying all sorts of things. We all were. I think we all went a bit mad after Katie died. But for God's sake, Louise didn't hurt Mum. Honestly, I think if she'd had a gun or a knife that day, maybe she would have, but she didn't. I wanted to tell the whole truth. I really did. Not to the woman detective. Not even to Julia, really. But I wanted to tell Sean. But I couldn't. It would have been a betrayal. And after everything I'd done, I couldn't betray Katie now. So I said all I could. Louise didn't do anything to my mother, okay? She didn't. Mum made her own choice. I got up to go, but D.S. Morgan wasn't done yet. She was looking at me, this strange expression on her face, like she didn't believe a word I'd been saying. And then she said, "You know what strikes me as odd, Lena? You don't seem remotely curious as to why Katie did what she did, and why your mother did what she did. When someone dies like this, the question everyone asks is why. Why would they do that? Why would they take their own lives when they have so much to live for? But not you. And the only reason I can think of for that is because you already know." Sean took me by the arm and led me from the room before I could say anything. Lena. Julia wanted to drive me home, but I told her I felt like a walk. It wasn't true, but A, I didn't want to be in the car alone with her, and B, I saw Josh on his bike across the road, going round and round in circles, and I knew he was waiting for me. "Sup, Josh?" I said, when he came riding over. When he was about 9 or 10, he started saying sup to people instead of hello, and Katie and I never let him forget it. Usually he laughs, but this time he didn't. He looked frightened. "What's wrong, Josh? What's happened? What were they asking you about?" he said, in this little whispery voice. "It's nothing. Don't worry. They found some pills that Katie took, and they think that the pills, might have something to do with what happened. They're wrong, obviously. Don't worry." I gave him a little hug and he pulled away, which he never does. Usually he'll use any excuse to have a cuddle or hold my hand. "Did they ask you about Mum?" he said. "No, well, yeah, I suppose, a little. Why?" "I don't know," he said, but he wouldn't look at me. "Why, Josh?" "I think we should tell," he said. I could feel the first spots of warm rain on my arms, and I looked up at the sky. It was deathly dark, a storm coming over. "No, Josh," I said. "No, we're not going to tell." "Lena, we have to." "No," I said again, and I grabbed his arm more tightly than I meant to, and he yelped like a puppy when you step on its tail. "We made a promise. You made a promise." He shook his head, so I dug my nails into his arm. He started to cry. "But what good does it do now?" I let go of his arm and put my hands on his shoulders. I forced him to look at me. "A promise is a promise, Josh. I mean it. You do not tell anyone." He was right in a way. We weren't doing any good. There was no good to be done. But still, I couldn't betray her. And if they knew about Katie, they'd ask questions about what happened afterwards. And I didn't want anyone to know about what we did. Mum and I. What we did and what we didn't do. I didn't want to leave Josh like that. And I didn't want to go home anyway. So I put my arm around him and gave him a comforting squeeze. And then I took his hand. "Come on," I said to him. "Come with me." I know something we can do, something that will make us feel better. He turned bright red, and I started laughing. Not that, you dirty boy. He laughed too then, and wiped the tears from his face. We walked in silence towards the southern end of town, Josh pushing his bike along beside me. There was no one about. The rain was coming down harder and harder, and I could feel Josh sneaking the occasional glance across at me because my t-shirt was now totally see-through and I wasn't wearing a bra. I crossed my arms over my chest and he blushed again. I smiled, but I didn't say anything. In fact, we didn't talk at all until we got to Mark's Road. And then Josh said, "What are we doing here?" I just grinned at him. When we were outside Mark's door, he asked again, "Lena, what are we doing here?" He looked frightened again, but excited too. And I could feel all the adrenaline rushing up inside of me, making me feel dizzy and sick. "This," I said. I picked up a stone from under the hedge and chucked it as hard as I could against the big window at the front of his house, and it went straight through, just making a small hole. "Lena!" Josh yelled, anxiously looking around to see if anyone was watching. They weren't. I grinned at him and picked up another stone and did it again, and this time it shattered the window and the whole pane came crashing down. "Come on," I said to him, and I handed him a stone, and together we went round the whole house. It was like we were high on hatred. We were laughing and shouting and calling that piece of shit every name we could think of.
The Drowning Pool. Katie. 2015. On the way to the river, she stopped from time to time to pick up a stone or a piece of brick, which she put into her backpack. It was cold, not yet light, though if she turned back to look in the direction of the sea, she would have seen a hint of grey on the horizon. She did not turn back, not once. She walked quickly at first, down the hill towards the centre of town, putting some distance between herself and her home. She didn't head straight to the river. She wanted, one last time, to walk through the place she grew up in, past the primary school, not daring to look at it in case flashbacks to her childhood stopped her in her tracks, past the village shop, still shuttered to the night, past the green where her father had tried and failed to teach her to play cricket. She walked past the houses of her friends. There was a particular house to visit on Seaward Road, but she couldn't quite bring herself to walk along it, so instead she chose another, and her pace slowed as her burden became heavier, as the road climbed back towards the old town, the streets narrowing between stone houses clad with climbing roses. She continued on her way, north past the church, until the road took a sharp turn to the right. She crossed the river, stopping for a moment on the humpbacked bridge. She looked down into the water, oily and slick, moving quickly over stones. She could see, or perhaps only imagine, the dark outline of the old mill, its hulking, rotting wheel still unturned for half a century. She thought about the girl sleeping inside, and laid her hands, bluish-white with cold, on the side of the bridge to stop them from trembling. She descended a steep flight of stone steps from the road to the riverbank path. On this track she could walk all the way to Scotland if she wanted to. She'd done it before, a year ago, last summer. 6 of them, carrying tents and sleeping bags. They did it in 3 days. They camped next to the river at night, drank illicit wine in the moonlight, telling the stories of the river, of Libby and Anne and all the rest. She couldn't possibly have imagined back then that one day she would walk where they had walked, that her fate and theirs were intertwined. On the half mile from the bridge to the drowning pool, she walked slower still, the pack heavy on her back, hard shapes digging into her spine. She cried a little. Try as she might, she could not stop herself from thinking about her mother, and that was the worst, the very worst thing. As she passed under the canopy of beech trees at the riverside, it was so dark she could barely see a foot in front of her, and there was comfort in that. She thought that perhaps she would sit down for a while, take off her pack and rest. But she knew that she couldn't, because if she did, the sun would come up and it would be too late, and nothing would have changed, and there would be another day on which she would have to get up before dawn and leave the house sleeping. So, one foot in front of the other. One foot in front of the other, until she reached the tree line. One foot in front of the other, off the path, a little stumble down the bank, and then one foot in front of the other, into the water.
Jules, you were making up stories, rewriting history, retelling it with your own slant, your own version of the truth. The hubris, Nell, the fucking hubris. You don't know what happened to Libby Seaton, and you certainly don't know what was going through Katie's head when she died. Your notes make that clear. On the night of Midsummer's Day, Katie Whittaker went into the drowning pool. Her footsteps were found on the beach at its southern edge. She wore a green cotton dress and a simple chain around her neck, a bluebird charm engraved "With Love." On her back, she carried a pack filled with bricks and stones. Tests carried out after her death revealed she was sober and clean. Katie had no history of mental illness or self-harm. She was a good student, pretty and popular. The police found no evidence of bullying, either IRL or on social media. Katie came from a good home, a good family. Katie was loved. I was sitting cross-legged on the floor in your study, leafing through your papers in the late afternoon gloom, looking for answers, looking for something. In amongst the notes, which were disorganized and in disarray, barely legible scribbles in the margins, words underlined in red or crossed out in black. There were pictures too. In a cheap manila folder I found printouts on low-grade photography paper. Katie with Lena, two little girls grinning at the camera, not pouting, not posing, throwbacks to some distant, innocent pre-Snapchat era. Flowers and tributes left at the edge of the pool, teddy bears, trinkets, footprints in the sand at the edge of the pool. Not hers, I presume. Not Katie's actual prints, surely. No, they must have been your version, a reconstruction. You followed in her footsteps, didn't you? You walked where she walked. You couldn't resist feeling what it felt like. That was always a thing with you. When you were younger, you were fascinated by the physical act, the bones of it, the viscera. You asked questions. Would it hurt? For how long? What did it feel like to hit water from a height? Would you feel yourself break? You thought less, I think, about the rest of it, about what it took to get someone to the top of the cliff or to the edge of the beach and to propel them to keep moving. At the back of the folder was an envelope with your name scrawled on the front. Inside was a note on lined paper, written in a shaky hand. I meant what I said when I saw you yesterday. I do not want my daughter's tragedy to become part of your macabre project. It's not just that I find it repulsive that you would gain financially from it. I have told you time and time again that I believe what you are doing to be deeply irresponsible, and Katie's death is proof of that. If you had an ounce of compassion, you would stop what you are doing now. Accept that what you write and print and say and do has consequences. I don't expect you to listen to me. You've shown no sign of doing so in the past. But if you continue down this path, I've no doubt that someday someone will make you listen. It wasn't signed, but it was obvious it came from Katie's mother. She warned you, and not just this once either. In the police station, I'd listened to the detective ask Lena about an incident just after Katie died, about how she threatened you and told you she would make you pay. Is that what you wanted to tell me? Were you afraid of her? Did you think she was coming for you? The idea of her, a wild-eyed woman, mad with grief, hunting you down, it was horrifying. It frightened me. I no longer wanted to be here among your things. I raised myself to my feet, and as I did, the house seemed to shift, to tilt like a boat. I could feel the river pushing against the wheel, urging it to turn, water seeping into cracks widened by accomplice weed. I rested one hand on the filing cabinet and walked up the stairs into the living room, silence buzzing in my ears. I stood for a moment, my eyes adjusting to the brighter light, and for a second I felt sure that I saw someone, there on the window seat, in the spot where I used to sit. Just for a moment, and then she was gone. But my heart bludgeoned my ribs, and my scalp prickled. Someone was here, or someone had been here, or someone was coming. My breath quick and shallow, I half ran to the front door, which was bolted just as I'd left it. But in the kitchen, there was a strange smell, something different, sweet, like perfume, and the kitchen window was wide open. I didn't remember opening it. I went over to the freezer and did something I almost never do. I poured myself a drink, cold, viscous vodka. I filled a glass and drank it quickly. It burned all the way down my throat and into my belly. Then I poured myself another. My head swam, and I leaned against the kitchen table for support. I was keeping an eye out, I suppose, for Lena. She'd disappeared again, refusing to be given a lift home. Part of me was grateful. I hadn't wanted to share a space with her. I told myself it was because I was angry with her, supplying diet pills to another girl, body-shaming her. But really I was afraid about what the woman detective said, that Lena isn't curious, because Lena already knows. I couldn't stop seeing her face, that photo upstairs with her sharp teeth and her predatory smile. What does Lena know? I went back to the study and sat down on the floor again, gathered up the notes I'd pulled out and began to rearrange them, trying to establish some sort of order, trying to get a sense of your narrative. When I came to the picture of Katie and Lena, I stopped. There was a smudge of ink on its surface, just beneath Lena's chin. I turned the picture over in my hands. On the reverse, you had written a single line. I read it aloud. Sometimes troublesome women take care of themselves. The room darkened. I looked up, and a cry caught in my throat. I hadn't heard her, hadn't heard the front door go, or her footsteps crossing the living room. She was just there all of a sudden, standing in the doorway, blocking the light. And from where I was sitting, the shadow profile was Nell's. Then the shadow stepped further into the room, and I saw Lena, a smear of dirt on her face, her hands filthy, her hair tangled and wild. "Who are you talking to?" she asked. She was hopping from one foot to the other. She looked hyper, manic. "I wasn't talking, I was..." "Yes, you were," she giggled. "I heard you. Who are you..." She broke off then, and the curl of her lip disappeared as she noticed the picture. "What are you doing with that?" "I was just reading. I wanted..." I didn't have time to get the words out of my mouth before she was upon me, towering over me, and I cowered. She lunged at me and grabbed the picture from my hands. "What are you doing with this?" She was trembling, her teeth gritted together, red-faced with rage. I scrabbled to my feet. "This has nothing to do with you!" She turned away from me, placed Katie's picture on the desk, and smoothed it over with her palm. "What right do you have to do this?" she asked, turning back to face me, her voice trembling. "To go through her stuff? To touch her things? Who gave you permission to do this? She took a step towards me, kicking over the glass of vodka as she did so. It flew up and smashed against the wall. She dropped to her knees and began gathering up the notes I'd been sorting through. You shouldn't be touching this! She was almost spitting with rage. This has nothing to do with you! Lena, I said, don't! She drew back sharply with a little gasp of pain. She put her hand on a piece of glass. It was bleeding. She grabbed a sheaf of the papers and clutched them to her chest. Come here, I said, trying to take the papers from her. You're bleeding. Get away from me! She piled the papers onto the desk. My eye was drawn to the smear of blood across the top sheet and the words printed below it. Prologue, in heavy type, and below that, When I was 17, I saved my sister from drowning. I felt hysterical laughter rise in me. It burst out of me so loudly that Lena jumped. She stared at me in amazement. I laughed harder at the furious look on her beautiful face, at the blood dripping from her fingers to the floor. I laughed until the tears came to my eyes, until everything blurred, as though I were submerged. August 1993. Jules. Robbie left me on the window seat. I drank the rest of the vodka. I'd never been drunk before. I didn't realize how quickly the twist comes, the slide from elation to despair, from up to down. Hope seemed suddenly lost, the world bleak. I wasn't thinking straight, but it felt as though my train of thought made sense. The river is the way out. Follow the river. I've no idea what I wanted when I stumbled off the lane, down the bank onto the river path. I was walking blindly. The night seemed blacker than ever, moonless, silent. Even the river was quiet, a slick, frictionless, reptilian thing sliding along beside me. I wasn't afraid. What did I feel? Humiliated. Ashamed. Guilty. I looked at him. I watched him. Watched him with you. And he saw me. It's a couple of miles from the mill house to the pool. It must have taken me a while. I wasn't quick at the best of times, but in the dark, in that state, I'd have been slower still. So you didn't follow, I suppose. But eventually you came. I was in the water by then. I remember the cold around my ankles and then my knees, and then sinking softly into blackness. The cold was gone, my whole body burning, up to my neck now, no way out, and no one could see me. I was hidden. I was disappearing. Not taking up too much space. Taking up no space at all. The heat buzzed through me. It dissipated and the cold returned, not on my skin, but in my flesh, in my bones, heavy, like lead. I was tired. It seemed a very long way back to the bank. I wasn't sure I could make it back. I kicked out and down, but I couldn't reach the bottom, and so I thought that perhaps I would just float for a while, untroubled, unseen. I drifted. Water covered my face, and something brushed against me, soft, like a woman's hair. There was a crushing sensation in my chest, and I gasped, gulping water. Somewhere in the distance, I heard a woman scream. Libby, you said, you can hear her. Sometimes at night, you can hear her beg. I struggled, but something squeezed my ribs. I felt her hand in my hair, sudden and sharp, and she pulled me deeper. Only witches float. It wasn't Libby, of course. It was you, shouting at me, your hand on my head, holding me down. I was fighting to get away from you, holding me down or dragging me out. You grabbed at my clothes, clawed at my skin, gave me scratches on my neck and arms to match the ones Robbie had left on my legs. Eventually we were on the bank, me on my knees, gasping for breath, and you standing above me, shouting at me, "You stupid fat bitch, what were you doing? What the fuck are you trying to do?" You fell to your knees then, and put your arms around me. Then you smelled the alcohol on me, and started yelling again, "You're 13, Julia! You can't drink! You can't! What were you doing?" Your bony fingers dug into the flesh of my arms. You shook me hard. "Why are you doing this? Why? To spite me? Is that it? To make Mum and Dad angry with me? Jesus, Julia, what have I ever done to you?" You took me home, dragged me upstairs and ran a bath. I didn't want to get in, but you manhandled me, wrestling me out of my clothes and into the hot water. Despite the heat, I could not stop shivering. I would not lie down. I sat, hunched over, the roll of my belly tight and uncomfortable, while you scooped hot water over my skin with your hands. "Jesus, Julia, you're a little girl. You shouldn't be... You shouldn't have..." You didn't seem to have the words. You wiped my face with a cloth. You smiled. You were trying to be kind. "It's okay. It's okay, Julia. It's okay. I'm sorry I yelled at you, and I'm sorry he hurt you. I am. But what did you expect, Julia? What did you honestly expect?" I let you bathe me, your hands so much softer than they had been in the pool. I wondered how you could be so calm about it now. I thought you'd have been angrier, not just with me, but on my behalf. I supposed I must have been overreacting, or that you just didn't want to think about it. You'd made me swear that I wouldn't tell our parents about what happened. "Promise me, Julia, you won't tell them. You won't tell anyone about this, okay? Not ever. We can't talk about it, all right? Because we'll all get into trouble, okay? Just don't talk about it. If we don't talk about it, it's like it didn't happen. Nothing happened, okay? Nothing happened. Promise me. Promise me, Julia, you'll never speak about it again." I kept my promise. You didn't.
2015. Helen. On her way to the supermarket, Helen passed Josh Whittaker on his bike. He was drenched through and had mud on his clothes. She slowed the car and wound down her window. "Are you all right?" she called out, and he waved and bared his teeth at her, an awkward attempt at a smile, she supposed. She drove on slowly, watching him in the rear-view mirror. He was dawdling, turning the handlebars this way and that, and every now and again standing up on his pedals to check over his shoulder. He'd always been an odd little character, and the recent tragedy had exacerbated things. Patrick had taken him fishing a couple of times after Katie died, as a favour to Louise and Alec, to give them some time to themselves. They'd been at the river for hours and hours and, Patrick said, the boy barely spoke a word.
"They should get him away from here," Patrick said to her. "They should leave."
"You didn't," she replied softly, and he nodded.
"That's different," he said. "I had to stay. I had work to do."
After he retired, he stayed for them, for her and for Sean. Not for them, but to be close to them, because they were all he had. Them, the house, the river. But time was running out. No one said anything, because that's just the sort of family they were. But Patrick wasn't well. Helen heard him coughing in the night, on and on and on. She saw in the mornings how it pained him to move. The worst thing of all was that she knew it wasn't solely physical. He had been so sharp all his life, and now he had become forgetful, confused sometimes. He would take her car and forget where he'd left it, or sometimes return it to her filled with junk, as he had the other day. Rubbish he'd found? Trinkets he'd taken? Trophies? She didn't ask, didn't want to know. She was afraid for him. She was afraid for herself, too, if she was completely honest. She'd been all over the place lately, distracted, unreasonable. Sometimes she thought she was going mad, losing her grip. It wasn't like her. Helen was practical, rational, decisive. She considered her options carefully, and then she acted. Left-brained, her father-in-law called her. But lately, she had not been herself. The events of the past year had unsettled her, thrown her off course. Now she found herself questioning the things about her life she'd thought were least open to interrogation. Her marriage, their family life, even her competence in her job. It started with Sean. First with her suspicions and then, via Patrick, the awful confirmation. Last autumn she had discovered that her husband, her solid, steadfast, resolutely moral husband, was not at all what she thought him to be. She'd found herself quite lost. Her rationale, her decisiveness, deserted her. What was she to do? Leave? Abandon her home and her responsibilities? Should she issue an ultimatum? Cry? Cajole? Should she punish him? And if so, how? Cut holes in the fabric of his favourite shirts, break his fishing rods in half, burn his books in the courtyard. All of these things seemed impractical or foolhardy or simply ridiculous, so she turned to Patrick for advice. He persuaded her to stay. He assured her that Sean had seen sense, that he deeply regretted his infidelity, and that he would work to earn her forgiveness.
In the meantime, he said, he would understand, well, we both would, if you would like to take the spare room here. It might do you good to have some time to yourself, and I'm certain it would benefit him to get even a small taste of what he stands to lose.
Almost a year later, she still slept in her father-in-law's house most nights. Sean's mistake, as it came to be known, was just the start of it. After she moved into Patrick's home, Helen found herself afflicted by terrible insomnia, a debilitating, anxiety-inducing waking hell, which, she discovered, her father-in-law shared. He couldn't sleep either. He'd been that way for years, so he said. So they were sleepless together. They stayed up together, reading, doing crosswords, sitting in companionable silence. Occasionally, if Patrick had a nip of whiskey, he liked to talk about his life as a detective, about how the town used to be. Sometimes he told her things which disturbed her. Stories of the river, old rumours, nasty tales long buried and now dug up and revived, spread as truth by Nell Abbott. Stories about their family, hurtful things. Lies. Libelous falsehoods, surely. Patrick said it wouldn't come to libel. Wouldn't come to law courts.
Her lies won't ever see the light of day. I'll see to that, he told her.
Only that wasn't the problem. The problem, Patrick said, was the damage she'd already done to Sean, to the family.
Do you honestly think he'd have behaved the way he has if it hadn't been for her? Filling his head with these stories, making him doubt who he is, where he comes from. He's changed, hasn't he, love? And it's her that's done that.
Helen worried that Patrick was right, and that things would never go back to the way they'd been. But he assured her they would. He'd see to that, too. He'd squeeze her hand and thank her for listening and kiss her forehead and say,
You're such a good girl.
Things got better, for a while, and then they got worse. For just when Helen found herself able to sleep for more than a couple of hours at a time, just when she caught herself smiling at her husband in the old way, just when she felt the family moving back towards its old, comfortable equilibrium, Katie Whittaker died. Katie Whittaker, a star of the school, a diligent and polite student, an untroubled child. It was shocking, inexplicable. and it was her fault. She had failed Katie Whittaker. They all had. Her parents, her teachers, this whole community. They hadn't noticed that happy Katie needed help, that she wasn't happy at all. While Helen was laid low by her domestic problems, befuddled by insomnia and plagued with self-doubt, one of her charges had fallen. By the time Helen arrived at the supermarket, the rain had stopped. The sun was out and steam rose from the tarmac, bringing with it the smell of the earth. Helen scrabbled around in her handbag for her list. She was to buy a joint of beef for dinner, vegetables, pulses. They needed olive oil and coffee and capsules for the washing machine. Standing in the canned goods aisle, looking for the brand of chopped tomatoes she considered most flavoursome, she noticed a woman approach and realized with horror that it was Louise. Walking slowly towards her, her expression vacant, Louise was pushing a giant, near-empty shopping trolley. Helen panicked and fled, abandoning her own trolley and scurrying to the car park, where she hid in her car until she saw Louise's own vehicle swing past and out into the road. She felt stupid and ashamed. She knew that this wasn't like her. A year ago, she wouldn't have behaved in such a disgraceful way. She would have spoken to Louise, squeezed her hand and asked after her husband and son. She would have behaved honourably. Helen was not herself. How else could she explain the things she'd thought of late, the way she had acted? All this guilt, this doubt, it was corrosive. It was changing her, twisting her. She was not the woman she used to be. She could feel herself slipping, slithering as though she were shedding a skin. And she didn't like the rawness underneath. She didn't like the smell of it. It made her feel vulnerable. It made her feel afraid.
Sean. For several days after my mother died, I didn't speak. Not a single word. So my father tells me in any case. I don't remember much about that time, although I do remember the way Dad shocked me out of my silence, which was by holding my left hand over a flame until I cried out. It was cruel, but it was effective. And afterwards, he let me keep the cigarette lighter. I kept it for many years. I used to carry it around with me. I recently lost it. I don't recall where. Grief. Shock. It affects people in strange ways. I've seen people react to bad news with laughter, with seeming indifference, with anger, with fear. Jules's kiss in the car after the funeral, that wasn't about lust. It was about grief, about wanting to feel something, anything other than sadness. My mutism when I was a child was probably the result of the shock, the trauma. Losing a sister may not be the same as losing a parent, but I know that Josh Whittaker was close to his sister, so I'm loath to judge him, to read too much into what he says and does and the way he behaves. Erin called me to say there had been a disturbance at a house on the southeastern fringes of town. A neighbour had called, saying she'd arrived home to see the windows of the house in question broken and a young boy on a bike leaving the scene. The house belonged to one of the teachers at the local school, while the boy, dark-haired, wearing a yellow T-shirt and riding a red bike, I was fairly certain was Josh. He was easy to find. He was sitting on the bridge wall, the bike leaned up against it, his clothes soaked through and his legs streaked with mud. He didn't run when he saw me. If anything, he seemed relieved when he greeted me, polite as ever. "Good afternoon, Mr. Townsend." I asked him if he was okay. "You'll catch cold," I said, indicating his wet clothes, and he half smiled. "I'm all right," he said. "Josh," I said, "were you riding your bike over on Seaward Road this afternoon?" He nodded. "You didn't happen to go past Mr. Henderson's house, did you?" He chewed on his bottom lip, soft brown eyes widening to saucers.
Don't tell my mum, Mr. Townsend. Please don't tell my mum. She's got enough on her plate.
A lump formed in my throat, and I had to fight back tears. He's such a small boy and so vulnerable-looking. I kneeled down at his side. Josh, what on earth were you doing? Was there anyone else there with you? Some older boys, maybe? I asked hopefully. He shook his head, but didn't look at me.
It was just me.
Really? Are you sure? He looked away, because I saw you talking to Lena outside the station earlier. This wouldn't have anything to do with her, would it?
No,
he cried, his voice a painful, humiliating squeak.
No, it was me. Just me. I threw rocks at his windows. At that bastard's windows.
Bastard was enunciated carefully, as though he were trying out the word for the first time. Why on earth would you do that? He met my eye then, his lower lip trembling.
Because he deserved it,
he said.
Because I hate him.
He started to cry. Come on, I said, picking up his bike. I'll drive you home. But he grabbed hold of the handlebars.
No,
he sobbed.
You can't. I don't want Mum to hear about this. Or Dad. They can't hear this. They can't.
Josh. I crouched down again, resting my hand on the saddle of his bike. It's all right. It's not that bad. We'll sort it out. Honestly, it's not the end of the world. At that, he began to howl.
You don't understand. Mum will never forgive me.
Of course she will. I suppressed an urge to laugh. She'll be a bit cross, I'm sure. But you haven't done anything terrible. You didn't hurt anyone. His shoulders shook.
Mr. Townsend, you don't understand. You don't understand what I've done.
In the end, I took him back to the station. I wasn't sure what else to do. He wouldn't let me drive him home, and I couldn't leave him by the side of the road in that state. I installed him in the back office and made him a cup of tea, then got Callie to run out and buy some biscuits.
You can't interview him, sir, Callie said, alarmed. Not without an appropriate adult.
I'm not interviewing him, I replied tetchily. He's frightened, and he doesn't want to go home yet. The words triggered a memory. He's frightened, and he doesn't want to go home. I was younger than Josh, just 6 years old, and a policewoman was holding my hand. I never know which of my memories are real. I've heard so many stories about that time from so many different sources that it's difficult to distinguish memory from myth. But in this one, I was shivering and afraid, and there was a policewoman at my side, stout and comforting, holding me against her hip protectively while men talked above my head. "He's frightened and he doesn't want to go home," she said.
"Could you take him to your place, Jeannie?" my father said. "Could you take him with you?"
That was it. Jeannie. WPC Sage. My phone ringing brought me back to myself.
"Sir?"
It was Erin.
"The neighbour on the other side saw a girl running off in the opposite direction. A teenager. Long blonde hair, denim shorts and white T-shirt."
"Lena, of course."
"Yeah, sounds like it. You want me to go and pick her up?"
"I'll leave her for today," I said. "She's had enough. Have you managed to get hold of the owner, of Henderson?"
"Not yet. I've been calling, but it's going straight to voicemail. When I spoke to him earlier, he said something about a fiancée in Edinburgh, but I don't have a number for her. They may even be on the plane already."
I took the cup of tea into Josh.
"Look," I said to him, "we need to get in touch with your parents. I just need to let them know that you're here and you're okay, all right?
I don't have to give them any details, not right now. I'll just tell them that you're upset and that I brought you here to have a chat. That sound okay?" He nodded. "And then you can tell me what it is that you're upset about, and we'll take it from there." He nodded again. But at some point, you are going to have to explain the business about the house. Josh sipped his tea, hiccuping occasionally, not quite recovered from his earlier emotional outburst. His hands were wrapped tightly around the mug, and his mouth worked as he tried to find whatever words he wanted to say to me. Eventually, he looked up at me.
"Whatever I do," he said, "someone is going to be upset with me."
Then he shook his head.
"No, actually, that's not right. If I do the right thing, everyone is going to be upset with me. And if I do the wrong thing, they won't. It shouldn't be like that, should it?"
"No," I said, "it shouldn't. And I'm not sure you're correct about that. I can't think of a situation in which doing the right thing will make everyone upset with you. One or two people, maybe. But surely if it's the right thing, some of us will see it that way and be grateful to you." He chewed his lip again.
"The problem," he said, his voice trembling again, "is that the damage is already done. I'm too late. It's too late to do the right thing now."
He cried again, but not like before. He wasn't wailing or panicking. This time, he cried like someone who has lost everything. Lost all hope. He was in despair, and I couldn't bear it. "Josh, I must get your parents here. I must," I said, but he clung to my arm.
"Please, Mr. Townsend, please."
"I want to help you, Josh, I really do. Please tell me what it is that's upsetting you so much." I remembered sitting in a warm kitchen, not me own, eating cheese on toast. Jeannie was there. She sat at me side.
"Won't you tell me what happened, darling? Please tell me."
I said nothing. Not a word. Not a single word. Josh, though, was ready to speak. He wiped his eyes and blew his nose. He coughed and sat up straight in his chair.
"It's about Mr. Henderson," he said. "About Mr. Henderson and Katie."
Thursday, the 20th of August. Lena. It started as a joke, the thing with Mr. Henderson. A game. We'd played it before, with Mr. Fryer, the biology teacher, and with Mr. McIntosh, the swimming coach. You just had to get them to blush. We took turns trying. One of us would go, and if they didn't succeed, then it was the other person's turn. You could do whatever you liked. And you could do it whenever you liked. The only rule was that the other person had to be present, because otherwise it wasn't verifiable. We never included anyone else. It was our thing. Mine and Katie's. I don't actually remember whose idea it was. With Fryer, I went first, and it took about 30 seconds. I went up to his desk, and I smiled at him and bit my lip when he was explaining something about homeostasis, and I leaned forward so that my shirt gaped open a bit, and bingo. With McIntosh, it took a bit more work, because he was used to seeing us in our swimming costumes, so it wasn't like he was going to go mad over a bit of skin. But Katie got there in the end, by acting sweet and shy, and just a little bit embarrassed when she talked to him about the kung fu films we knew he liked. With Mr. Henderson, though, it was another story. Katie went first, because she'd won the round with Mr. Mack. She waited until after class, and while I was packing away my books really slowly, she went up to his desk and perched on the edge of it. She smiled at him, leaning forward a bit, and began to speak. But he pushed his chair back suddenly and got to his feet, taking a step backwards. She carried on, but half-heartedly, and as we were leaving he gave us a look like he was furious. When I tried, he yawned. I did my best, standing close to him and smiling and touching my hair and my neck and nibbling my lower lip, and he yawned, really obviously, like I was boring him. I couldn't get that out of my head. The way he looked at me like I was nothing. Like I wasn't interesting in the slightest. I didn't want to play anymore. Not with him. It wasn't fun. He just acted like a dick. Katie said, "Do you think so?" And I said I did, and she said, "All right, then." And that was that. I didn't find out that she'd broken the rules until much later. Months later. I had no idea. So when Josh came to see me on Valentine's Day with the most hilarious story I'd ever heard, I messaged her with a little heart picture. "Heard about your bae," I wrote. "KW and MH forever." I got a text message about 5 seconds later saying, "Delete that. Not joking, delete." I texted back, "WTF?" And she texted again, "Delete now or I swear to God I will never talk to you again." Jesus, I thought. Chill. The next morning in class, she ignored me. Didn't even say hello. On our way out, I grabbed her arm. "Katie, what is going on?" She virtually shoved me into the loos. "What the fuck?" I said. "What was that about?" "Nothing," she hissed at me. "I just thought it was lame, all right?" She gave me this look, one I'd been getting from her more and more. Like she was a grown-up and I was a child. "What made you do that anyway?" We were standing at the far end of the bathroom, under the window. "Josh came round to see me," I told her. "He said he saw you and Mr. Henderson holding hands in the car park." I started laughing. Katie didn't laugh. She turned away from me and stood in front of the basin, looking at her reflection. "What?" She pulled a mascara out of her bag. "What exactly did he say?" Her voice sounded strange. Not angry, not upset. It was like she was frightened. "He said he'd been waiting for you after school and he'd seen you with Henderson and you were holding hands." I started laughing again. "Jesus, it's not a big drama. He was just making up stories because he wanted an excuse to come and see me. It was Valentine's Day, so..." Katie squeezed her eyes shut. "God, you're such a fucking narcissist," she said quietly. "You really do think everything is about you." I felt like I'd been slapped. "What?" I didn't even know how to respond. It was so unlike her. I was still trying to think of what to say when she dropped the mascara into the basin, gripped its edge and began to cry. "Katie." I put my hand on her shoulder and she sobbed harder. I put my arms around her. "Oh God, what's wrong? What's happened?" "Haven't you noticed?" she sniffed. "That things have been different. Haven't you noticed, Leenie?" Of course I had. She'd been different, distant, for a while. She was busy all the time. She had homework, so we couldn't hang out after school, or she was going shopping with her mum, so she couldn't come to the cinema, or she had to babysit Josh, so she couldn't come over that night. She'd been different in other ways, too. Quieter at school. She didn't smoke anymore. She'd started dieting. She seemed to drift out of conversations, like she was bored by what I was saying, like she had better things to think about. Of course I'd noticed. I was hurt. But I wasn't going to say anything. Showing someone you're hurt is the worst thing you can do, isn't it? I didn't want to look weak or needy, because no one wants to be around someone like that. I thought, "I don't know, Kay. I thought you were just bored with me or something." She cried even harder then, and I hugged her. "I'm not," she said. "I'm not bored with you, but I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell anyone." She broke off suddenly and pulled herself out of my arms. She walked to the other end of the room and sank to her knees, then crawled towards me, checking under each stool. "Katie, what are you doing?" It took until then for it to hit me. That's how clueless I was. "Oh my God," I said, as she got back to her feet. Are you actually saying... I lowered my voice to a whisper. There's something going on. She said nothing, but looked me dead in the eye, and I knew that it was true. Fuck! Fuck! You can't be... That is insane. You can't. Katie, you have to stop this before anything happens. She looked at me like I was a bit dim, like she felt sorry for me. Lena, it's already happened. She half smiled, wiping the tears from her face. It's been happening since November. I didn't tell the police any of that. It wasn't any of their business. They came to the house in the evening, when Julia and I were in the kitchen eating dinner. Correction, I was eating dinner. She was just pushing her food around her plate like she always does. Mum told me Julia doesn't like to eat in front of other people. It's a hangover from when she was fat. Neither of us were talking. We hadn't said anything to each other since I came home yesterday and found her with Mum's things. So it was a relief when the doorbell went. When I saw that it was Sean and Detective Sergeant Morgan, Erin, as I'm supposed to call her, now we're all spending so much time together, I thought it must be about the broken windows, although I did think that both of them coming seemed like overkill. I held my hands up to it right away. I'll pay for the damage, I said. I can afford it now, can't I? Julia pursed her lips, like she thought I was a disappointment to her. She got up and started clearing away the dishes, even though she hadn't eaten a thing. Sean took her chair and pulled it round so that he was sitting next to me. "We'll get to that later," he said, a sad and serious expression on his face. "But first, we need to talk to you about Mark Henderson." I went cold, my stomach flipping over like when you know something really bad is about to happen. They knew. I felt devastated and relieved at the same time, but I tried my best to keep my face totally blank and innocent. "Yeah," I said. "I know. I smashed up his house."
"Why did you smash up his house?" Erin asked.
"Because I was bored. Because he's a dick. Because..."
"That's enough, Lena," Sean interrupted. "Stop messing about."
He looked properly pissed off.
"You know that's not what we're talking about, don't you?"
I didn't say a word. I just looked out of the window.
"We've been talking to Josh Whittaker," he said,
and my stomach flipped again. I suppose I'd known all along that Josh wouldn't be able to keep quiet about this forever, but I'd hoped that smashing up Henderson's house might satisfy him, for a little while at least.
"Lena, are you listening to me?"
Sean was leaning forward in his chair. I noticed that his hands were shaking a bit.
"Josh has made a very serious allegation about Mark Henderson. He's told us that Mark Henderson was engaged in a relationship, a sexual relationship with Katie Whittaker in the months before she died."
"Bullshit," I said, and I tried to laugh. "That's total bullshit." Everyone was staring at me, and it was impossible to keep my face from going red. "It's bullshit," I said again.
"Why would he invent a story like that, Lena?" Sean asked me. "Why would Katie's little brother come up with a story like that?"
"I don't know," I said. "I don't know, but it's not true." I was staring at the table and trying to think of a reason, but my face just kept getting hotter and hotter.
"Lena," Erin said, "you're obviously not telling the truth. What's less clear is why on earth you would lie about something like this. Why would you try to protect a man who has taken advantage of your friend like that?"
"Oh, for fuck's sake!"
"What?"
she asked, getting right up in my face.
"For fuck's sake, what?"
There was something about her, about how close she got to me and the expression on her face that made me want to slap her.
"He didn't take advantage of her. She wasn't a child."
She looked really pleased with herself then, and I wanted to slap her even more, and she just kept talking,
If he didn't take advantage of her, why do you hate him so much? Were you jealous? I think that's enough, Julia said. But no one listened to her. Erin just kept talking, kept going on and on at me. Did you want him for yourself?